Turning your Bibles to Philippians chapter 2, we are heading into that second chapter. I was going to preach through verse 11 from verses 3 through 11 today, but I cut the sermon in half. You guys can thank me later on Tuesday. So, because I got captivated by kind of what Paul is doing, and hopefully I'm not going to lose you in the midst of the weeds. But I think that what he has to say is very, very important, and we need to understand it. I don't want to just gloss over it too quickly, because then it's meaningless. But let me go ahead and begin by going back to where we started last week, and read chapter 2, starting in verse 1. If you have, and I am providing the sense of the text, the original text here, if you have experienced any encouragement from being united with Christ, if you have experienced any comfort from His love, if you have experienced any fellowship with His Spirit, if you have experienced any tenderness and compassion, anybody here experience that? If you know Christ, you have more than you realize. Our goal is to connect with that, to be able to not just know it up here, but to be able to remove the obstacles that keep us from experiencing that here. He says, and make my joy complete. And that's the goal and the desire of any pastor, of any person who is mentoring you, is that you know what they want to see? We want to see people at Elam experience the fullness of what God has called us to live into. Because this is not just an intellectual ascent of faith, a walk. This is not just about knowing the right things and doing the right things. This is about experience the presence of God in our lives. That's what we're going. That's what gives us joy. To make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit, and being one in purpose. And I can't think of anything more that our world needs today. Is to have that sense of unity in the midst of a world that's tearing each other apart, that's bombing civilians, that's breaking up marriages, that's alienating parents from children and children from parents. I can't think of anything that we need more than just that sense of unity and that sense of oneness and that sense of flourishing that God has called humanity into through Jesus Christ. But it only comes through Jesus Christ. It only comes through Jesus Christ. But I know I want to experience that unity with my own kids. I want to experience it with my wife. I want to experience it with my friends. But here's the problem. We bring a lot of baggage into our relationships, don't we? A lot of baggage. This becomes painfully obvious when we get married, right? Can I be honest here? I didn't realize just how much baggage I had in my life until I got married. And I realized, wow, I'm a pretty messed up person. And if that wasn't enough, when I started having kids, don't even want to go there. You know, it's not that they made me that way. It's just that they began to kind of expose what was really within my own heart. I had a lot of baggage, and we all do. But if you're like me, you like to be able to say, but God, it's, if they would only do this, it's that wife you gave me, that woman you, I'm speaking third person now, okay? I'm speaking as if I'm Adam to God when they sinned in the garden and God says, Adam, what's going on? God, it's that woman you gave me. That's a double barrel, okay? He blamed God for the woman who was causing him problems, all right? That's shirking responsibility. That's shirking responsibility. Some people ask, well, why doesn't God just kind of get rid of all that stuff once we bow our knee before Him and that whole conversion process begins to take place? That's a sermon for another time. But suffice it to say, He doesn't. And that's why I must confess, folks, even to this very moment, I have baggage. I have baggage, and so do you. Right, Rich? We all have baggage that we're not even aware of. And Paul nails this in chapter 2 of Philippians, starting in verse 3. Basically, he is saying, in our relationships, do nothing out of, or a better sense of the text would be, don't be moved by, don't be compelled by in your relationships, selfish ambition, which is nothing more, it's a pretty simple concept, it's a divisive spirit. But where does that divisive spirit come from? Vain conceit is what he's referring to. And vain conceit is what I really want to focus in on. Because it's sort of the well where we dip our buckets to get the water from. And there's something wrong with that well and the water in that well, and that is it's polluted. And it's polluted by this concept of vain conceit. And Paul is saying to the Philippians, Philippians, you have a problem. We all have a problem, but you guys have a big problem, and it's being manifested by, how can I tell you have vain conceit? Because you guys are grumbling against one another. There's all kinds of this relational friction that's taken place within the church there, that takes place within the rest of the marriages, which takes place within the rest of humanity. This isn't just a church issue, this is a human issue. Now this word, the Greek word for vain conceit, is really one word, and it means literally empty of glory or empty of respect, a loss of a sense of weightiness, of significance. And what he's saying is this word means that there is a huge hole within our souls, a vacuum, sort of a cosmic insecurity that is hungry to be filled. It's hungry to have something come in it and give it that sense of significance, that sense of weightiness, that sense of importance. It's hungry to be filled. And the reason it's hungry to be filled is because we have this empty hole within our soul that feels like in our core being, I don't count. I don't have that sense of significance that my soul longs for. That vain conceit, it's empty conceit. There's a hole in my soul. And when we come to this awareness that something deep within us is empty, that becomes hell on earth for us. And we begin to approach other people. We approach our vocation. And we begin to say, you know what? I've got to get something from my vocation. I've got to find that sense of significance because I'm scared to death of failure. In our relationships, we look at one another and we say, you know what? I really long to connect with you because if I don't connect with you, I'm going to be lonely. I'm going to be missing something that I need desperately. Jonathan Edwards, one of the great, great theologians of the 18th century. He was a brilliant man, probably one of the most brilliant Christian theologians ever produced in America. He used to be president, I think it was of Harvard. Just an incredibly brilliant person. I had one professor tell me who went to Princeton and studied Edwards for his doctorate, his PhD, and he walked out of that saying, anyone who thinks they understand Edwards doesn't understand Edwards. He just had this incredible mind, but he really wrestled with this whole concept of vain conceit and this hole that exists within our souls, this sense of lack, this sense of need, and its impact upon how we choose to live life. And he came up with about 6 characteristics, but I'm only going to talk about 3 here because it gets pretty complex, but I think there's 3 core ideas that this whole idea of vain conceit drive us, it moves us, as Paul says, it motivates us to do 3 things. The first thing that it motivates us to do, that it moves us towards, is drivenness. It's drivenness is that compelling need that drives us to need to succeed because I'm terrified of failure. It drives me to that need to connect with others because, not because of what I may contribute to the relationship, that I may bring into the relationship out of a sense of wholeness, out of a sense of well-being, but it drives me to connect with you because I am terrified of being lonely. I'm terrified by finding myself alone. You see a lot of this happen in marriages and people who get married, especially in the midlife. You know, they're terrified of being alone in their older years. The thing that terrifies many people most is that as being at home and having no one care and feeling like no one counts. I had a woman walk up to me once. She had been missing church in my church in Southern California, and she had not been there in a couple of months. And she made, I called her, and I just said, "Hey, I just miss you. Miss seeing you." She walked up to me the next Sunday. She came, and she says, "You know, Martin, that meant so much to me because I felt invisible. I felt invisible. Drivenness says I must connect with you. I must connect with you because I'm terrified of being alone. I'm terrified of being alone." So this whole sense of a lack within our souls, this vain conceit, this sense of emptiness, of emptiness of any sense of significance or weight or glory, drives us with this drivenness. It moves us in many ways, but that's just two ways under drivenness. The second is that it moves us towards scornfulness. Scornfulness. Scornfulness is an older word. I thought, well, if I use scornfulness, I know people like my son are going to say, "What is scornfulness? Dad, there's a generation gap going here." Scornfulness is an older word. But scornfulness is a person who's scornful is a one who has a sort of a critical, fault-finding attitude towards others. It's just a sense of an edge. Where you find yourself drawn towards or inadvertently doing things like putting people down. Using sarcasm. Sort of a cutting humor, you know, sort of the joking beneath the surface, you know. Yeah, you see that so much. But it puts people down all in an effort to lift yourself up because it terrifies you to be less than someone else. It also moves you to prove yourself right and find others wrong. Prove yourself right and to find others wrong. How many of you like to be right? Okay, I have this passion, and I never realized it until I was writing a paper for my class on emotional health. And I had an aha moment, and there was this, and I was confronted with just within my own soul this need to be right. And I saw it as something very noble. It was anything but noble. It was scornful. It was rooted in a fear of, I can't handle being wrong. Imagine being married to me. Poor Kim, you can pray for her because there's still baggage in my life. But I'm getting better, right, babe? Right? Thank you. I need to know you got my back, babe, all right? But scornful people just have a way of kind of subtly putting people down and not even knowing it. Scornful person just holds people with sort of this underlying sense of contempt. And they struggle to do as James says when they hear something like what James writes in James chapter 1, verse 19. They struggle to be quick to listen. A scornful person is a person who struggles to hear and to really listen and not be formulating one's own thoughts in response, but to really listen to what another person is saying. And then to be able to hear what's being said behind the words, yet you understand what I'm saying? You know, what's this person really saying? And really kind of understand the woundedness that it's coming out of, and then to be able to empathize. A scornful person is not quick to listen. And they struggle to be slow to speak and because they're too easy to defend. They're too easy to blame and they're too easy to kind of, they're like a caged animal, you know. Nathan just moved into this house out in Roy area. It's on 5 acres and it's a double wide mobile home. And it's pretty run down. It's got some issues, but we knew that there were some inhabitants within this house before, you know, he moved in there. And we were moving him in last Monday, or last Friday evening. And Doc, his dog, was very interested in this chair. So we go over it, and Doc just, whoa, you know, he's a terrier, so he was after this chair. So I pick it up, and there was a mouse that ran out and went and ran into his boot. So I grabbed the boot and I shook it good, you know? And Kim was saying, honey, you're going to get blood all over the boot. And then I handed it to Nathan. And the mouse popped out and you should have seen him jump. I have no idea where I was going with this story. But it was someplace good. I lost my train. If anyone sees a train running around that without a conductor, let me know and I'll get back on board. But for now, I have no idea why I told that story. It made sense at the beginning. Anyhow, vain conceit moves us towards drivenness, scornfulness, and ultimately through stubbornness. And that is an arrogance in one's beliefs that makes one struggle to consider or even be considerate of the opinions of others. And I understand when I started thinking about that and thinking through that, I thought, well, I don't want to be considerate of the opinion of others if the opinion is wrong. And it doesn't mean that we... it doesn't mean that... that we accept a wrong opinion if the opinion's wrong. But it means we are considerate of the person who speaks that opinion, even if it's wrong. A person who is stubborn, who is arrogant in one's own beliefs, they struggle to be considerate of the opinions of others. They struggle to admit their own wrong and to take advice and correction except under duress. They struggle to be teachable and open to advice. That's vain conceit. That's what this sense of emptiness, a lack of weight, a lack of glory, doxa, will produce, is it moves us towards drivenness, towards scornfulness and towards stubbornness. So Paul is saying, do nothing. Don't allow your relationships to be moved towards this. Do nothing out of this selfish ambition and vain conceit. He's saying, you guys have a problem, and it's not just a church problem, but here's a bigger problem. We're often blind to this. In 2004, I started a doctorate program up in Trinity Western University in Langley, B.C., and I was scared to death to get into this program because I wasn't sure I had the intellectual horsepower to really be able to do it. I almost pulled out a month before. But Jeff Jordan, for those of you who remember, he says, Marty, you need to do this. So I went on ahead and I engaged with it and really enjoyed it. But the first professor I ever had, his name was Dr. Phil Zilla. He's the one who is the quote-unquote study Jonathan Edwards. And I remember going into this class, I just had all kinds of questions. And I just really started to engage, really enjoyed it. 3 years later, I get a call from him and says, Martin, I really would like you to join this new class that's coming in and go with us on this retreat that we always go on. And I said, oh, that's an honor. Sure, I'll go. He said, I just feel like I need someone who has some experience with some of these topics and these concepts that we're dealing with. This is great. And so it was over on Vancouver Island. And we were coming back from that retreat. And we were sitting on this ferry, and he looks at me, and he's with these other guys sitting around. And he said, Martin, you've changed a lot. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, I didn't know there was a problem. I don't know, I just whenever someone says, you've really grown, and you want to think, wait a minute, what are you saying? Yeah, the flip side of that, that's me, all right? It's that lack of glory, lack of weightiness. He says, you've really changed over the past few years. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you're not as overconfident as you were when you first started this class, this regime back in 04. And I was confused, and I thought, oh man, what was I like? And he says, you know, you just had this edge about you, like you had to prove yourself. You had this sense of, you weren't really teachable. What are you saying? He's saying, Martin, you were driven, you were scornful, and you were stubborn. And I was kind of taken back by that, but at the same time, I started feeling a little proud. And I didn't see that, but you know what? And I started looking around in my own mind's eyes, these other guys, and he just said I was humble. How do you guys like that? Now, I don't think I was as scornful or stubborn as he thought I was. I think I was just misunderstood back in those early years. But, you know, hey, it doesn't matter, you know. My point is this, is we don't see this. We have a hard time seeing this lack or this vain conceit which rests so deeply within our own souls. And it's something that we've got to be able to say, God, show me. Show me. I think that we all ought to be able to say, God, is there vain conceit deep within my own soul? And I would assume that the answer is yes. And it becomes, I have no idea what that is. Ben? Is that your phone? Maybe it's not. He's taking notes, actually. Okay, it's outside. All right. There's nothing I can do about that. Whoa, that someone had weird stuff for breakfast, huh? But you know, we all got to be able to say, God, uncover this stuff within me. Uncover this stuff within me. And this last week, as I was thinking about this concept, I found myself getting back into these and finding myself to be driven and scornful and stubborn at lesser and lesser levels, but it's still there. And Paul says, don't be moved by any of this. Instead, what are we to be moved by? And he goes on and he says, but in humility, consider others, or literally be moved to treat others in ways that are better than yourselves. In ways that are better than yourselves. Now, I love the translation in the sense of that word, consider, because it means to be moved. But who is it that moves us? It's what's called passive. It means something is acting upon you. Now, who is it that moves us towards humility? This is a church. There's one word. Jesus. Yes, God. He is the one who moves us through the power of His Spirit. We'll see this in 12, I think, where it says God is working in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Because that's what He's talking about here. He says, be moved by something far more profound than your selfish ambition and your vain conceit. And what is more profound is this, humility. In humility, consider others better than yourselves. Now that's wild. There are people who really struggle with that. I'm one of them. But what does he mean by that? What does he mean to treat someone as better? No one's better than me. Right? You ever think that? We're raised to believe that. No one is better than me. He's not talking about he's not making a qualitative statement. He's not saying consider others better ontologically and in their essence, better than you are. But what he's saying is this. He says, I'm not talking about being better than. I'm just asking you to treat others as if they're more important. They're not better than you. Just treat them as if they're more important. Or in other words, to go further for other people than you would naturally go for yourselves. unpack this. And he explains this next in verse 4. Each of you should look, or literally skopeo. I mean, I love that Greek word. It's a scope, like on a rifle. Each of you should look not only to your own interests. So he's saying, not saying deny yourself, but he says just don't focus on yourself, but also for the interests of others. Now, in our culture, in our society, this goes contrary to sort of this expressive individualism that we have in our culture. And so this, to hear this, it sounds unnatural and confusing. It's like he's calling us to be these George McFlys. Anybody ever see the movie Back to the Future? All right, one of the great classics of movies. You know, it'll live into infamy, all right? He's not talking to us about becoming this sort of this George McFly, where you're just a piece of gum on the bottom of somebody's shoe. That's not what he's talking about. What he's saying is he's saying, you know what? Choose a radically different path, a radically different posture, a radically different approach to relationships, and that approach is humility. But humility is incredibly confusing. In our day, culture says, stand up for yourself. Humility is considered to be weakness. It's considered to have a low opinion of yourself. And that's not what Paul is saying. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's not hating yourself. Humility is just thinking less about yourself. It's what parents try to train their children to do. Right? Parents, you want your children to think less of themselves or just less about themselves? It's just less about themselves. That's humility. It's just having an other person focus. And it's incredibly important, this whole concept. This concept was unknown and unaccepted. It was not considered a virtue when Paul wrote. It was considered to be a vice. Something that you did not want. And even in our own culture, you take William Bennett's book, what's it called, Virtues? Book of Virtues? Humility isn't even mentioned in it. But yet, humility is a virtue. It's the product of the transforming work of the gospel in our lives as we deal with this vain conceit and being moved by that. He's saying replace that with this, the sense of not thinking less of yourself, but just think less about yourself. That's the idea of what he's after here. It's used over 200 times in the New Testament. Why is that? Because that's what God is like. And we'll see that next week when I get to 5 through 11. But humility is incredibly confusing to us, and it's very counter to our nature. But humility, in and of itself, is this. It reveals a glorious strength. A sense of wholeness, a glorious strength. It reveals a humble person is not a weak person, it's not a weak-mannered person. A humble person is a person who has incredible strength within themselves, within the core of their being, within their soul. They have an incredible strength that says, I don't need to treat you in this way. I don't need to treat you with a drivenness, with a scornfulness, with a stubbornness. I don't get anything out of that, as opposed to a person who has vain conceit who says, I get everything from that. But a humble person who's being transformed into the image of Christ says, I don't have anything to prove. I don't have to prove to you that I'm right. I don't have to prove to you that I have the last word. I don't have to do that. I get nothing out of that. You see the incredible strength that is there? A person, a humble person, is not a weak person. It's a very strong person who looks at you and says, you know, I don't have anything to prove. I don't have anything to prove. I don't need to be moved by drivenness and scornfulness and stubbornness. If you disrespect me, if you wound me, yeah, it'll hurt, but I'm not diminished as a person. I don't think less of myself based upon how you treat me. It's his idea. You understand what I'm saying? Difficult concept, kind of a confusing concept. But this is what is the product, the result of the transforming power of the gospel in our lives. It's just, I don't have anything to prove. You agree with me or disagree with me, you choose. I don't have to have the last word, I don't have to prove myself right, and I don't have to prove you wrong. What freedom is that? What strength is that? So humility reveals a glorious strength. Humility reveals a compelling beauty. And that it frees us to love and serve others in healthy and unconditional ways. Healthy and unconditional ways. In other words, I'm able to serve Bill. I'm able to serve Bill not because I need something from him, or not because he earns something, or not so I'll get him to come over and work on my house or help me with this or that, but I'm able to serve him just because. This is the difference between a person who does loving things for another person because they're told to versus a person who does loving things for another person because they're a loving person. It comes out of something far deeper within. One way, you do loving things for another person because you get something out of it. You benefit from it in some way versus I do loving things for you just because I'm a loving kind of person. That's just the kind of person I am. That's the kind of person that God is turning me into. You see the freedom? You see the beauty of that? Isn't that incredible? How many of us would love to be able to be a loving kind of person and not just a person who does loving things? How many of us would love our spouse to be a loving kind of person, not just a person who does loving things? I really would, but that's vain conceit. There we go. But it's incredible beauty. So humility is of glorious strength. It's a compelling beauty, but humility also reveals a redemptive wholeness that's growing within us. It just feels so unnatural for us to choose humility over self. But you got to understand that our ability to do that reveals, is evidence of, is the fruit of the transforming work of the gospel in our lives. And it's evidence of the fact that God is changing me, not just changing me from this distorted, deformed person filled with baggage, but He is changing me and freeing me up to be the person that He created me to be originally. How cool is that? See, humility and serving the needs of others is not something that is contradictory to my human nature. It is in concert with my human nature. It's how God created me to be as a person made in His image. Now, why is it so important to understand that? Because we are made in His image, and that is the kind of God He is. That's why He could do what He did. Not because He got anything from it, but because that's just the kind of God that He is. And that is the kind of person He is redeeming us, changing us, transforming us back into. Amen? Amen? Amen. You understand what I'm saying? Yes. Really important. I'm giving you a vision for your humanity. I'm giving you a vision for your relationship. I'm giving you a vision for your marriage. Giving you a vision as a parent, the kind of person God's turning us into. That to me is compelling. Now, I found out this last week that one of my core strengths is I'm a persuader, so I'm trying to persuade you. All right? It's who I am. So get this, teens. Go home. Serve your parents, not just out of loving acts, but because you say, God, I want to become a loving kind of person. And not just a taker, but I want to become a giver. All right? Parents, go serve your kids. And they're saying, yeah! Incredible. But how do we become that person? Well, we've got to go back to the beginning of what Paul was saying in Philippians. Because this all builds. I pray that your love for God may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight in connecting with God. That's where the well is dug. That's where the water is put in, His water. That's what this all comes out of. I pray that your love and your connection with God may abound more and more in that connection, that knowledge, that epignosko. By the time we're out of Philippians, you're never going to want to hear that word again. And depth of insight, because you know His heart, so that you may be able to discern what is best. And that is not just what is right and wrong, but what is really in keeping with who God is and His will for my life and the kind of person He is calling and changing and transforming me into. You find that on your knees. And it's reinforced in chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. If you have experienced any encouragement from being united with Christ, that connection, if any fellowship of His Spirit, if any comfort from His love, if you're experiencing that in an ongoing way, it's changing you into this kind of person. And we've got to get this if we're going to understand next week's sermon. All right? Hopefully I'm not losing you into the weeds. So we get this. We become this kind of person through connecting with Him and through receiving from Him and through becoming preoccupied with Him. And that's next week. But I know some of us are thinking, Martin, this feels really dangerous. After all, what about my needs? Anybody ever wonder about that? I have. Because God created me for community. What about my needs? You know, it's not like we're this fully independent person, separate from other, you know, self-contained person who just gets everything from God and not from others. What about my needs? What do I do when I feel disconnected and alone and no one seems to really care about me? I need you to understand that when selfish ambition and vain conceit move me in that sense of need there, move me in my relationships, this makes me God. If I say, God, what about my needs? My needs are not being met. And I take over out of a sense of vain conceit rather than out of a sense of a spirit of humility. It makes me God and says, okay, you know what, God, you're not meeting my needs to this community. There's a hole within my soul and it's not being filled up quick enough or fast enough. I declare myself to be God and say, okay, you know what, I'm going to take care of this on my own. I'm going to take care of this on my own. And then that becomes toxic. And then when we don't get those needs met, we turn in judgment towards others and drivenness, scornfulness, and stubbornness. But when we choose to say, God, in the midst of the lack of fulfillment of my needs, I choose humility to move me in my relationships with others. What does this do? This draws me back to my knees before my Father. And moves me to pray, Father, I pray that my love for You may abound more and more in knowledge and depth of insight so that I may be able to discern what is best. So I may know how. I may have You fill me up. I'm drawn to the realization that God is my Father and I'm His desperately needy child, filled with baggage. I take my baggage to my Father. I don't take my baggage to my wife or to my community. Through demandingness, through drivenness, stubbornness, scornfulness. You see the difference? It's like we all have baggage. What do we do with it? Do we take it to God and say, God, You fill me up? Or do we take it to others and say, You fill me up? We take it to God. Very interesting statement is in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 17. Paul is coming down to the end of his life. And he's writing this final letter, and he's not whining, but he says, you know what? In the midst of all that I've been through, I've had all these people who have deserted me. I've had these people who have walked away from me. I've had these people who have persecuted me. He's not saying that to whine. He's saying that to help them understand where he is. And he says this, he says, but the Lord stood by my side. That's a man on his knees. That's a man who's saying, you know what, I'm not going to walk away from you because you didn't meet my needs and I'm mad at you and I'm hurt. Or I'm not going to put this expectation upon you to fill the hole in my soul, even though I long to receive some connection with you, but you're unable to fill. Even if you can connect with me, you're not going to be able to connect with me enough to fill my soul. It's, the hole is way too big. There's far too much vain conceit within this person right here. And God is the only one who can fill it, and God's the only one who can change it. And realize that in humility, that humility will strengthen and equip me with the capacity to maintain healthy and relational boundaries. I really went off into the weeds today to try to help us understand some of these important concepts, but let me bring it all back around one person, and it's Jesus Christ. We see this lived out in a very dramatic way in John chapter 13. And let me read to you just a little snippet of that passage. He's coming down to the end of his life. He's about to hang on the cross. His disciples are about to desert him, and one disciple in particular is going to betray him. His name's Judas. And he knows all of this is going to happen. But look at what he chooses to do. He doesn't walk away and say, "You guys are all losers. I'm going to go and work with this group of people." He doesn't walk away from them in scornfulness and drivenness and stubbornness. Instead, this is what he does. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Okay, he could have changed the outcome, and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So therefore, because he was connected with his Father, that's where his needs were being met. That's where he was getting his strength. So therefore, he got up and he did the most unthinkable thing. But it represents an incredible humility that was powerful, a humility that was beautiful, and a humility that revealed the redemptive wholeness within his own human soul. And it's this. He said he got up from the meal and took off his outer clothing and wrapped the towel around his waist. And after that, he poured water into the basin and began to wash the disciples' feet. The God of the universe drying them with a towel that was wrapped around him. The Creator of all that we see models what Paul is speaking of here. What beauty. What strength, what wholeness. And this wasn't in contradiction to who he was. He didn't do this in spite of the fact that he was God-man. He did this because he was God-man. You see the difference? He didn't do just a servant act of kindness. He was a servant. He was a servant. Next week, we're going to talk about the motivating force for us, and that is the preoccupation with Christ and how that just moves us in this direction. But think about that as we come to this table this morning. Because this table represents, he served them the meal that these represent after he washed their feet. And realize that if you were sitting around that table in your present condition, he would have come up to you. He would have bowed before your feet. He would have grabbed them and he would have washed them. Not just to do a loving thing, but because he loves you. We don't see a greater picture of Christ than what we've been talking about this morning, except for maybe next week. Just an incredible, incredible picture. But he sat with his disciples and he says this, after he washed their feet and he looked each one in the eye and he knew that Judas was going to betray him and that Peter was going to deny him. And the rest of them were going to run away. And he looked at them out of a sense of beautiful wholeness and redemption. He offers them this and he says, "This is my body, which is broken for you. Do this, eat this, in remembrance of not what I just what I did for you, but what I am calling you into." And then after supper, he took the cup and he said, "The picture is not complete. It's only half done." And he says, "This cup is a new covenant in my blood. Drink this. Do this in remembrance of me." Father, we thank you for the incredible beauty that we oftentimes lose sight of because it gets veiled in the midst of the routine and the mundane. But Father, you call us out of that routineness and that sense of the mundane, and you want to give us a 3D high definition picture of what you've done and what you're calling us into. And Father, I pray that you would continue to do that this week. Father, as we seek to find ways to and places and space where we can bow before you and say, "God, remove the vain conceit, and Father, expose the vain conceit that's within my own soul. And Father, out of that, fill us so we may choose to do more for others than what we would even do for ourselves. Not because you're calling us into a new moral attitude or a new ethical framework, but because you are redeeming us to experience the fullness of what you've created us to be as your children." And all God's people said, "Amen.